Children being physically, emotionally, verbally, and sexually abused, being neglected, not receiving the care they deserve. It happens every day in this country. What is the link between poverty and child maltreatment, and what can be done about it? I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year. Joining me today are two professors from the UW-Madison School of Social Work whose research interests include child maltreatment, parenting behaviors, child welfare systems, and ways to assist families in helping children grow up in the best environments. They are co-authors of studies such as The Economic Safety Net for Low-Income Families with Children, Child Protection and Child Well-Being, and Wisconsin's Community Response Program for Families that have been reported for child maltreatment. Professor Lawrence Berger is the director of the Institute for Research on Poverty. Professor Kristen Slack is in the UW School of Social Work, as is Lonnie Berger as well. Welcome to both of you to University of the Air.
Thank you for having us.
It's great to be here.
It's a really important topic. You know, we read about child abuse every day. There's some terrible news story that comes out. Maybe you could start by just talking a little bit about the scope of the problem and some of the terminology that we might need to know, because child maltreatment I'm less familiar with as a term compared to child abuse.
So in our country, we tend to measure child maltreatment and trends in child maltreatment by looking at the number of kids who are reported for abuse and neglect and whose cases are or allegations are substantiated. So that victimization rate has lingered around 9 or 10 per thousand kids for the last 4 or 5 years or so. But that's obviously just the tip of the iceberg, because not every child who is maltreated is noticed or reported to Child Protective Services. So there's a much bigger phenomenon that underlies all of those statistics and trends.
And definitionally, you know, so within the child maltreatment category, we're really talking about several different things. We're talking about child physical abuse, which is, I think, what most people think of in terms of the system, sexual abuse, emotional abuse or neglect, and child neglect. And, one of the things that I think is not well understood by the general public is that the vast majority of the system's actually for child neglect. So failure to provide for children in terms of food, clothing, shelter, medical care, educational needs, emotional needs, those kinds of things. And, you know, that's more than two-thirds of the child maltreatment system is really neglect cases, not the physical and sexual abuse that are often the high-profile cases that we read about in the paper.
How did each of you get into this particular field, this particular area within the field, where you're looking at child neglect, child maltreatment, and in this case, the overlap between that and poverty?
I think that my interest really began over 15 years ago now, when we were debating federal welfare reform in this country. And a big question at that time that not a lot of people were asking is, how might these changes in our economic safety net for low-income families affect rates of involvement with the child welfare system or the child protection system? Neglect, which, as Lonnie said, is the most common form of maltreatment, is also the form of maltreatment most closely associated with poverty. And so it stood to reason that if you change our economic safety net in a way that might be harmful to some families, that you could see an increased risk of involvement in the child protection system.
Yeah, and I think partly that, I was drawn to it, as I started. I had got an MSW and then went on for my doctorate. You know, I felt like there are so many overlapping issues when thinking about child maltreatment, or how, the conditions kids grow up in, how kids are treated. And so, it was really a way to think about how there was a confluence of economic factors, mental health issues, substance abuse. So how does all of this play out in children's lives? And so to me, it was an outcome that reflected a wide variety of social issues, of social ills, there was a real draw for me to study. So, what leads to kids being maltreated, and what can public policy do to try to prevent maltreatment?
Sometimes the university has the reputation for studying problems kind of in its ivory tower, you know, studying poverty and studying disability, studying different things, but not actually bridging the gap between that and the real life people who are suffering. Do you ever find yourself feeling like you're working on studies and meanwhile, you know, children are being abused and that there needs to be more of a link between the research and what's being put in practice?
So I think there's always a little bit, of that possibility and that fear. I also think that, you know, in particular, University of Wisconsin has a history of working very closely with the state. And even, you know, when I came to interview for a faculty job here, Christy was already here. And I, you know, some of my interviews and my appointments were with people at the Department of Children and Families, whatever the old name was then, but the department. And that's sort of it may be partly, you know, school of social work specific, but I think there is this connection between the university and the state here. And so it's been this great opportunity where we work very closely with the Children's Trust Fund here. We work closely with the Department of Children and Families to really make the research count and to really talk to policymakers and practitioners about what we're learning and sort of share information between each other. And I think that that's relatively rare to have that close a relationship between a university and a state. It's one of the things that I really value about being at Wisconsin.
The prevention community here, too, the child maltreatment prevention community, we both work very closely with a number of stakeholders there. And I would say, you know, right away when I came here in 2000, I started making connections with that community. And I'd get a lot of questions about the relationship between poverty and maltreatment because you have a lot of people in the field who are trying to understand whether what they're seeing in a family is really reflective of just lack of basic needs, or is it about parenting, problematic parenting? And child protection workers, too, struggle with this. There's sometimes a very fuzzy line between whether what they're seeing is poverty or what they're seeing is neglectful behavior. And when we look at this relationship between poverty and maltreatment, one thing I always like to make sure we're very clear about is that not all people who are living in poverty maltreat their kids. It's actually a very small portion. But when you look at it from the other side, from the child protection system side, the vast majority of families that get involved in the child protection system have very low incomes. And so there's a very strong correlation, and poverty elevates the risk of both getting involved in child protective systems as well as it elevates the risk for certain behaviors that are proxies or markers of maltreatment. And so we would hear those discussions a lot with people out in the field, and we felt really compelled to try to understand the phenomenon more to be able to give them tools to work with.
I know there's a lot of statistics that show that people who are at poverty are much more likely to be in prison, to have stronger sentences, that there are attitudes too. And if you don't have legal counsel, that makes a difference. But I assume there are many different variables here in terms of the link between poverty and child abuse. Let's start by the notion of, not being able to provide a child with basic needs. So a child shows up at school and, doesn't seem to have proper clothing, doesn't seem to be cared for. What are the rules right now in Wisconsin for when Child Protective Services gets involved, who is mandated to report it, and for which kinds of concerns?
Right now, our definition of neglect, which this question is mostly related to, states that it's, neglect is the failure to provide for some of these basic needs for reasons other than poverty. So there's an attempt in our statutory definition, and this is true in many other states as well, to separate out, what is poverty versus what is neglect. But, as I said, it's just very difficult to tease that out sometimes, and because we live in a country where sometimes people get blamed for the poverty they're living in. Mm-hmm. There's this issue of how responsible is that parent for not having enough food for the child. And so you have to try to figure out, is it a question of this parent's making the best possible choice out of a lot of bad options and doing the best they can, and they just need help? Or is this a situation where it's within the parent's control, you know, to provide for a child, and for whatever reason, they're just not able to or choosing not to?
The other thing that I would just add is that, you know, in child maltreatment statutes, intent is irrelevant. So it's the outcome that matters. So it doesn't matter if the mom was trying to do her best, right, but the kid was still either, you know, left in a dangerous position or harmed. It's actually the situation that the child's in that matters. So if, you know, a mom has low cognitive skills and isn't able to do good budgeting, and that's the reason that the child doesn't have the coat or the food, that is not, you know, that's not statutorily, that doesn't make it non-neglect, that the mom didn't have the ability, right? The same with, so, physical child abuse. If, a mom went to spank a kid and didn't mean to cause a bruise or harm, that's irrelevant. There was the bruise, there was the harm, and therefore it's child abuse.
And when is spanking abuse? Because also there are cultures where the sort of spare the rod philosophy is very deeply embedded. You know, what right now, because I actually don't know that, like, let's say it's a first grader shows up in school, has been spanked. Is it only when certain kinds of bruises appear that it's considered to be abuse?
So this is a huge debate in the child welfare field, right? So you actually like nailed one of the biggest debates. So it depends on the state, depends on the jurisdiction, depends internationally. So in some countries, spanking and corporal punishment are completely illegal. Other places, and it, you know, varies by state, it's really about there's got to be an evidence of harm. So it's about leaving a mark. Or about leaving a bruise or things like that. So child maltreatment in the child welfare field in general is one of the areas where as a society we've largely agreed that once a child has crossed some threshold of being abused or neglected, government has the right to intervene in that family. Where the debate is what's that threshold? And mm-hmm. spanking is a great example of that, that, you know, it really varies widely.
And what about in terms of the school's responsibility when it comes to a child that's comes into the school system and is lacking in certain areas? And I think, you know, I hear from a lot of people where they're afraid to call Child Protective Services because they know it could make it worse. You know, that let's say you have a family where there are some problems that are happening, but there's also love in that household. And, you know, you call Child Protective Services and sometimes then the child is taken out of the home and into foster care where things can go even more wrong at times. I work with adults at the poverty level right now in a program called the Odyssey Project. Many of them were actually raised in foster care and report incidents that they experienced of many kinds of abuse. Usually they were taken out of a home because of the mother's substance addiction or things that had, the mother might have been incarcerated or something else happened to disrupt that family. And it seems as if it's not always a great solution. And so, you know, I'm just curious for teachers and school psychologists and people working right now in Wisconsin, what are the guidelines for when they do call CPS?
Right. You know, and there are mandatory reporting laws, and we, as a state, have many venues for training mandated reporters on what the statutes are and what the process is for making those reports. There are some jurisdictions where I think the schools and CPS, Child Protective Services, work really well together, and they have a very strong understanding of what types of scenarios warrant a call. There's other jurisdictions where there's hardly any communication and there's even disagreement about what should be reported and acted upon. But it's, I believe, after many, many years of working with child protection staff, that there is a very diligent effort to try to keep kids with their parents if there's any way to do that. And removal from the home and placement in foster care is really reserved as a last resort. But we've all heard horror stories about mm-hmm. kids, you know, being removed from situations that some would argue they shouldn't have been removed from and then not coming home ever. So it's not that that doesn't happen, but I do think sometimes we only pay attention to the negative cases. Mm-hmm. And there are just so many examples of good strengths-based work, you know, that goes on in doing these investigations and trying to set up a safety plan for keeping the kid in the home, the children in the home.
What do you see as the biggest cause of child maltreatment?
So cause is an interesting word. So if we look at predictors of child maltreatment, things that are correlated with child maltreatment, so across the world, income is the most consistent predictor of child maltreatment. So even if you look, you know, in the U.S., if you look at particularly other developed countries, right, the child protection system, and to the extent that we have data on actual maltreatment behaviors, there's a very large relationship with income. The question becomes, so does that mean that income causes maltreatment? Or are so essentially, or are both of them caused by some other set of factors, right? So we could think about, so maybe there are mental health problems or substance abuse problems or physical health problems or cognitive skills problems. And those things are driving both the fact that a family has limited income, limited resources, and the fact that they're maltreating. And so what becomes really important from a policy perspective is sorting out which is going on, right? So if it really is a question of income causing maltreatment, and so you could think of that happening for a couple reasons. So very directly, if we think about these thresholds, right, falling below a threshold of being able to provide for a kid in a bunch of areas, even if technically it should not be for reasons of poverty alone, it's really hard to sort out what's actually poverty and what's actually poor decision making or poor management on the part of parents. So there may be this direct link between income and maltreatment. There also may be this indirect link. So it's well known that a drop in income, right, or experiencing low income, even if it's stable, is associated with higher levels of stress and with poorer decision making, right? It's also well known that drops of income and low income status is associated with harsher parenting, more stressed parenting, lower quality home environment. So these are reasons you might think that income's causal. If that's the case, then investing in income support programs may well have the added benefit of preventing child maltreatment, which is extremely expensive. If it's not the case and you believe that income is driving child maltreatment, but what's really happening is it's mental health and it's substance abuse and it's all these other, you could pour a lot of money into income supports and have no effect on the child maltreatment rate. And so that's why it's really difficult to – and that's why Christy and I have focused a lot of our careers and our research on trying to disentangle the real role that income is having as far as a cause. I focused on income because this is what a lot of our research is about. But there really is essentially a host of risk factors that are seen as predictors or factors that increase the probability of child maltreatment, and we really don't have a good sense of which of those are causal, right? So it's really largely thought to be about a whole group of contextual factors and personal characteristics, and in many ways in interaction with one another that sometimes lead to child maltreatment for some families and don't for others.
So what would be some of the other risk factors besides low income then?
I think mental illness, substance abuse, as you've mentioned, domestic violence. There sometimes severe cognitive limitations can hamper parenting abilities, mm-hmm. and the ability to provide a safe environment to kids.
What about the age of the parent? Is teen parenthood a predictor?
So teen parenthood is a large risk factor. Is it the age in and of itself, or is it essentially, there's been a lot of work on the adolescents and the developing brain, right? Adolescents are more impulsive. They're, you know, you have less experience. You're less likely, you know, kids make worse decisions than adults on average. So again, it's not clear that it's a cause, but it's certainly a risk factor. And more generally, you know, a lack of knowledge of child development is a huge risk factor. So a lot of times what you might be seeing is what ends up being abuse or neglect is literally inability or failure to recognize what's developmentally appropriate behavior on the part of a child and how a parent needs to respond. So your 11-month-old won't stop crying. And so if you don't know much about child behavior, you might think that this 11-month-old has the ability to control that they're not stop crying. So I'm going to spank this 11-year-old so that they learn not to cry, right? Mm-hmm. Which realistically is the exact wrong response to have if you want the child to stop crying, right? But it takes a certain degree of knowledge about, you know, what an 11-month-old can and can't control and how they respond.
I think one other large risk factor is just one's own childhood experience.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask about whether
parented.
This generational kind of effect.
And it's interesting, though, there's not, this intergenerational transmission theory of maltreatment is probably one of the leading theories in this field in terms of understanding what might cause maltreatment. But the research on it isn't completely consistent, and it doesn't work necessarily in the way you'd think it would work. So you'd think, you know, if you were physically abused as a child, maybe you learn that type of parenting or discipline strategy, and then you use that same strategy with your own children. But it's not necessarily the same type of trauma in childhood and then the same type of trauma with your own children or behaviors with your own children.
You mean, so let's say I had been beaten as a child, then I have a child of my own. I might not beat that child, but I might
neglect
them in a different way.
Exactly. So it's not necessarily about learned behaviors. And so we haven't quite sorted out in this intergenerational maltreatment literature what the exact mechanisms are, but certainly having had an experience of being abused or neglected as a child does raise the risk that your own children will be abused and neglected, and not necessarily by you. It might be by a partner, and you might be in select into a relationship or form a relationship with a higher risk individual who is responsible then for the abuse or neglect.
So I'd also just sort of like to comment on what we mean by cause in this context. So, you know, at the beginning of our conversation, Christy said, you know, the vast majority of poor people don't maltreat their children. And, you know, I said, oh, the biggest risk factor for child maltreatment is low income or poverty. And so I think it's important to think about when we're talking about a cause, we're clearly not talking about a one-to-one relationship. If you're poor, you're going to maltreat. We're not even talking about a one distinct probability. We're talking about an average probability across all poor people. And we're talking about – or all people in this sense. And what we're sort of talking about is, you know, if your income's at a certain amount or falls below a certain amount, that there's a probabilistic relationship between an increased risk of maltreatment and, you know, dollars of income or whatever. And so an analogy is really you could think about smoking, right? Everybody who smokes is not going to get lung cancer, right? But we can say it's a cause of lung cancer because we see that there is a probabilistic relationship between smoking and lung cancer that can't be explained by any other factor, any other variable. And that's essentially what we're trying to do in this literature too, is say if we want to say mental illness is a cause or income is a cause, we want to try to get at what's the statistical relationship between these two things that is isolated to this particular factor and can't be explained by anything else.
More on poverty and maltreatment of children when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Lawrence Berger and Kristen Slack. We are talking about child maltreatment and the role that poverty might play in that maltreatment of children. Here in Wisconsin, a city that gets a lot of attention in terms of sort of broken families, poverty, racism, a lot of inner city kinds of problems is Milwaukee. And I know that you've been involved in some research work there. Can you talk about that?
So as we were talking about before, Lonnie and I both have an interest in trying to understand this causal role that poverty might play in maltreatment. And one of the best ways to try to understand cause is to do a randomized experiment. Now, we don't want to be in a position of randomizing families into situations of poverty, but you can take a group of families who is struggling with poverty and randomly assign them to receive economic support. And then the question becomes, how much child maltreatment prevention can you achieve if you just intervene around economic stressors in a low-income family?
So if I follow you right, then you take a group of families, all that are at the poverty level, and then you give, say, half of them more money and see what the incidence then of child maltreatment would be in, among the two groups?
So conceptually, that's great. That's not exactly what we're doing in the project, but conceptually, that's the idea.
It's a good thing I'm not doing it because I would just so much want to just give everybody money.
Yeah.
That was definitely our first idea. But we really wanted to see what we could achieve working within the systems that already exist. And so the intervention that we have worked collaboratively with the Wisconsin Children's Trust Fund on for the past almost 10 years now is called Project GAIN, and it's located in Milwaukee, and it's delivered by the Social Development Commission in Milwaukee. Project GAIN stands for Getting Access to Income Now. And families that are randomized into the treatment group are referred to Project GAIN, and Project GAIN has three pillars of the intervention.
So we should just say how the families are randomized, mm-hmm. right? So essentially, it's families who are reported to the Child Protective Services system. So there's really two immediate screening points. So one is when Child Protective Services gets a call. They have to decide whether there's enough information to warrant an investigation. And so nationally, about a third of the calls, there's not enough information, so they're screened out. And then the second step is to go out and do an investigation. And so the families that are being selected for the intervention are families where the Bureau of Milwaukee Child Welfare went out, investigated the family to find out if maltreatment had occurred, and there was no finding of maltreatment. So,
or no child safety concerns.
No child safety concerns. So these families typically will, the investigation will end. They might get a few referrals, some phone numbers, piece of paper, whatever. A few might get some more direct services, but generally they're not going to get much of anything at all. And it turns out that they end up getting re-reported to child protection at quite high rates. And so often you'll see a family is reported three or four times before a victimization determination, a substantiation of maltreatment. And so these are the families who had touched the system, but essentially there was no finding of maltreatment, were deflected, who typically don't get any services that were randomized to get this economic support service.
But they would be seen as at risk for coming back into the
exactly.
system.
Right, and they're primarily very low-income families.
And so what did you discover then after giving GAIN, what did you say it was for? Getting access to income now. Okay.
We have wonderful staff running this program. They are just phenomenal, and they've all been there for almost 5 years, the same group of folks. They're very knowledgeable about the economic safety net, and so they have a very detailed understanding of eligibility rules around various benefits for low-income families. They have relationships with various systems to help advocate for families that may struggle filling out paperwork or getting to talk to a worker, some of the bureaucratic red tape they can help with. And they also have a lot of skills around helping a family make financial decisions, good financial decisions. And by this, we don't mean you know, how to save for retirement or how to save for college for your kids, but you have 10 bills and you can't pay them all, what's the most strategic way to pay them so that you don't get exorbitant late fees or have other consequences mm-hmm. kind of build from these unpaid obligations? And so they work with families to try to figure out how might we be able to save you $50 a month or $100 a month just making slightly different decisions? How can we hook you up to any benefits you're not getting that you are eligible to receive? And then we have a small pot of emergency funding for situations like a family that's about to be evicted, or there's, you know, no food in the home, or there was a job that just got offered, but it requires a uniform that the family can't afford. But the point of the intervention is that it has to all be around supporting the family's economic situation. And that way, if it does show an impact, if the treatment group comes back less often to the child protection system than the control group who doesn't get this intervention, then we can know that the economic support had a causal role.
But you still would have to wonder if it's the actual money or the caring professionals that are working sure. with a family. And, you know, in other words, you're not just handing an envelope of cash.
Correct.
Right. And it's a... age-old problem with interventions like this, because there's typically a relationship involved with whoever is delivering the intervention. We hope to follow families that are in the treatment and control groups for 3, 4, 5 years. The intervention's actually quite short. It's only about 6 to 8 weeks. If it is about the relationship and nothing else, you might expect those differences between the treatment and control group to dissipate over time. Mm-hmm. If it is about putting them on a slightly different course to have a stronger financial situation, then you would hope that you'd see a more persistent effect.
Yeah, and for a large number of the families, it's literally one or two visits. So it may be that, you know, part of just knowing somebody cared, paid attention has an effect. But for many of them, it's literally what happens is a worker shows up at your door, has a laptop, has lots of information, goes through what you might be eligible for, and helps you get connected to these programs. I should also note that we use economic support kind of writ large. So it's not just, oh, can I get on SNAP or food stamps, which we do work on, or Badger Care, our healthcare system. It's also referrals for job training, for GED programs, for, you know, things
that could translate
into economic outcomes. And so for many of these families, literally, the worker comes, talks to them, tells them you may be eligible for this, helps them fill out the forms, or just gives them lets them know what forms need to be filled out, and that's it. And then we'll have the ability to follow. So first to see if economic resources really did improve for families, and then subsequently, were they less likely to be re-reported to Child Protective Services and to have further child welfare outcomes.
And do you have enough data to kind of make a conclusion?
So we're doing it now. By the end of the project, we'll have a little over 4,000 families, right?
That's right.
Yeah. And the idea is to follow, you know, the earliest group, so the data will be collected over about a little over 3 years, and to follow the earliest group, hopefully for about 5 years from the date they were randomized, and then the later group, it'll be more like a year or two. So this has really been done in partnership with the Department of Children and Families here, as Christy mentioned, the Children's Trust Fund. A colleague of ours, Michael Collins, who's at the Center for Financial Security, has been involved. And so we're going to have this ability to look at both using administrative data on program participation and then some survey data on, how do the families make financial decisions? How do families parent? So was there an effect potentially through – so we'll actually measure stress. We'll measure parenting behavior. So – if we see this increase in resources, is that associated with subsequent parenting behaviors that are better than they were at the time that families were randomized?
I was going to ask you if if lack of education is another risk factor, because I would think that parents that are more educated and also have sort of – of course, that goes along with also usually having more means, you know, getting out of mm-hmm. poverty is often through education. Mm-hmm. But do you find that there is a link between the educational level of the parents and the risk factor for?
So absolutely. But again, the question is, it's not clear that it's causal, right? So education is also correlated with all of those other things we talked
about. And I
also
think it's important to say that, you know, we try really hard to understand whether what we're seeing when we see this involvement with child protection systems and, you know, the things that elevate the risk of that involvement, we try to understand, is what we're seeing an artifact of some families living in poverty being under more surveillance by various systems that they're involved in? And perhaps they're more likely to be labeled as maltreating, or perhaps a mandated reporter is more likely to interpret what they're seeing as maltreatment and make that phone call. So this surveillance effect is also really important to try to tease out. A lot of the research, though, has looked not only at poverty's relationship with CPS involvement, it's also looked at its relationship with various parenting behaviors, and the relationship's still there. So we don't think it's entirely a surveillance effect, but it's just important to say that, because involvement in child protection systems doesn't necessarily – it's not necessarily synonymous with maltreatment per se. And so we're trying to understand – both phenomena, and looking at it through this experimental study.
And there are two other things that I think are really important about this program that I'd like to mention. The first is that, yeah, you mentioned before, like, why not just give them an envelope of cash? So for an experiment, that would be ideal, right? Then you really get this causal effect. We know we gave each family $1,000, or we gave each family a certain amount. We chose, and it was a conscious decision, to not go that route and to focus on connecting families with existing programs, public and private, because we felt like that was a politically and a policy relevant option. Whereas, you know, creating some new stream of money where you could just give families who were low income or were at risk of maltreatment a big cash benefit just seemed to be going nowhere to us. And so what we really like is, whether you agree with the policies or not, these are policies that we've deemed as a society that if you're eligible for this, you know, if you cross the threshold, you're eligible. And so what we really tried to focus on was not creating anything new, but trying to get families connected to things they were already eligible for. The second thing I'd like to say is, so we get a lot of pushback and questions often that, oh, well, you know, all these families have mental health problems, or many of these families have mental health problems or domestic violence problems or substance abuse problems. Why are you only giving them economic assistance? And so I think there's two – so I think this is really important for the testing piece, for getting at, you know, what's the role of income. In the real world, you know, we wouldn't necessarily say – only give these families this. So what we – but if we want to know how important this piece is, we have to focus on it. So the idea is, if we gave them all the, you know, mental health and all the other things, you wouldn't know at the end of the day if the program was successful what drove that success. And so our thinking is, if income indeed has a plays a causal role, then, you know, we could introduce aspects of Project Gain to other existing programs. So combine it with mental health, combine it with home visiting, combine it with domestic violence services. So part of the decision around only to offer this set of services was about the research. But it's really important. And so one, you know, an additional reason it's important is, so think about increasing people's education or decreasing serious mental health problems or substance abuse. These take a long time. Right. And they're, you know, relatively hard to conquer. So people have relapses. You know, they're very difficult problems, particularly in a context of low income and poverty. And to some extent, if there really is a role of income, it's a relatively low hanging fruit and a relatively easy thing to know how to deal with. Right.
One of the cases that I can think of from the past that seems – it's always stayed in my mind as a tragic example of where low income can affect an outcome, you know, where you have not only child neglect or maltreatment, but the death of a child. And that's a case where, let's say you have a young mother who is working to try to be able to feed her family. And, you know, the wages are very low. You cannot really live well on them. And the whole benefit system can sometimes make it where if you get a raise, then you lose some benefits. So let's say she's struggling. She can't afford child care. Cannot afford that child care, is just going to eat into the wages. So she leaves a baby with a boyfriend and comes home and the baby's dead, where she wouldn't have had that sort of, you know, I need to try to support this family, but I've got no good child care situation. I mean, I think the absence of affordable and high quality child care can be a problem too, right?
Absolutely. And one of the things that I said earlier that I want to be able to say again is many of these families are loving families. The parents are loving parents. They're trying as hard as they can, but they are working within a set of constraints that are largely there because of having very low income levels and not having the same opportunities as perhaps higher income parents have. And so they'll often make a decision that they think is the best decision, even if it means there's some risk still at play. And then you have these tragic outcomes sometimes because they're not completely avoidable when you're dealing with any number of risks. And I think it speaks a little bit to, speaks a lot to the importance of our welfare system and our economic safety net. Because if we find in our study of GAIN that providing families with more economic support and more stable incomes reduces child maltreatment by even 10%. That means those families, that 10% of families that were deemed at risk for maltreatment, they shouldn't have even been in the CPS system to begin with. There should be a way to serve them better in our welfare system where the economic supports are. And so there is a relationship between the strength of our economic support systems and the child protection system. In other countries where there's a very strong economic safety net, you don't see the same rates of particularly neglect, the form of maltreatment most closely tied with poverty, and you tend to only see cases coming into child protection systems that are much more egregious and are much more obviously maltreatment. I don't know if you want to add anything to the international context, Lonnie.
Yeah, I mean, the international context among the developed countries, you know, the wealthier countries, you know, most other countries have a more holistic approach to providing for children and providing for families. So they're often child allowances. There's universal child care often. There's, you know, longer family leaves. Mm-hmm. So all of those things are sort of less common in the English-speaking countries in general, and particularly uncommon or particularly less generous in the U.S. And so what you actually do see is a very different group in some ways of families involved with the child protective services system and a much more voluntary system. So in many of the countries, a lot of the child removals and things like that are actually the child protection system has met with the parents and they've come to the determination jointly that it's best for a child to go into foster mm-hmm. care for some period of time.
Less of a sort of criminal process. Yeah. We're going to look at some solutions when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Kristen Slack and Lawrence Berger. We are talking about the role of poverty in child maltreatment. You were mentioning, Lonnie, right before the break, that in other countries there are better safety nets, that, you know, all kinds of things in place so that you don't have quite as high an incident of child neglect, child maltreatment. And I was thinking, if we've got this wealthy country, United States, we have some people making billions, all kinds of corporations with all this money, yet we have child abuse every day. Children are being maltreated in terrible ways. Let's turn our attention in the remaining minutes that we have to what can we do about it. If you think about the different parts of our society, from the government to the schools to the various agencies to the something like university and a social work school mm-hmm. like you're in, who can do what to improve things, assuming that that's everyone's goal?
So I think that, one of the things that we haven't traditionally done super well in the U.S. is work on prevention as opposed to compensation, So we often respond once a child has been maltreated instead of thinking about what are the types of things that we could put in place before they get to be in contact with the child protective services. So your example of mom has to go to work and doesn't have a child care, so that's a great example. So whether it was leaving a child with a dangerous boyfriend or leaving a child who's too young to be at home alone, right? So is that really a child protective services question or is that a child care question? And so lots of these things we could do to get kids out of this system, right, who are really only there because of other types of problems.
The environment.
So the environmental problems mm-hmm. and lack of other supports. There are prevention programs, a few good home visiting programs that have been shown to reduce child maltreatment. Some other programs, Durham, North Carolina, had the Durham Connects was a county-based program of trying to coordinate services. It started with screening all pregnant women or all new moms. Then there was, depending on level of risk, there were home visiting options. There were a variety of different kinds of interventions based on, individual family needs. And this started right at the birth. And so I think that there is large potential to reduce child maltreatment and the number of kids that come to the attention of Child Protective Services through a variety of prevention programs. And look, every year it's about 6 million children that are getting reported to child maltreatment. So it's about 4.5% of all kids. Only about 1% are going to be found to be victims. But this is a huge number of kids.
And that's only the ones that are reported.
Right. And that's only the ones that are reported. Mm-hmm. So doing some things up front is not only going to be good for these kids and families, but I think we're starting to create a body of evidence that says it will save society considerable dollars. But it'll take an upfront investment.
I also think that we're starting to see, for the first time, a really strong shift in thinking about who's responsible for maltreatment. Our ideas about preventing child maltreatment over the last several decades have really been focused on how do you change the parent? How do you focus on that parent to get them to parent differently? Parenting, 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 parenting. But there's a growing recognition that communities have a role, agencies have a role, schools mm-hmm. have a role. And so you see really with just within the last 10 years, programs like what Lonnie was mentioning in North Carolina, where there's much more of an infrastructure that people are striving to put in place to help keep kids safe and their families stable. And that involves domestic violence networks. It involves mental health systems. It involves alcohol and drug abuse treatment. And it involves everybody being on the same page about what they're looking at as a risk factor and whose responsibility it is to do something about that risk factor. There's also been a shift into to really focusing more on family strengths and protective factors. So it used to just be about all the bad things.
Right, but you find strengths and build
right,
on that.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so you'll see a lot more. You see a lot more of that now in the kinds of prevention programs that are out there. And I think those two trends bode really well for us being able to tackle this this problem and make a bigger dent.
There's a line in a Blake poem where he says, pity would be no more if we did not make somebody poor. In other words, that we wouldn't be needing to go around with all this charity and, you know, pitying people and having programs to help these poor people if we just had a better economic system and leveled the playing field. To what extent do you find yourself, as you're working in this area of child maltreatment, getting indignant or outraged or, you know, incensed about our economic system as a whole?
Well, you know, we probably both have some things to say about this, but one point I always like to make is that, you know, for many, many decades in America, we're very uncomfortable with the notion of people being dependent on welfare benefits, whether that be temporary assistance for needy families, what we call Wisconsin Works or W-2 here, whether it be food stamps, we now call SNAP benefits. This idea of families being dependent on these benefits has really been something we're not willing to accept. Yet, on the other hand, low-wage work, even if you work full-time, does not raise you above the poverty line in most cases. And so almost by necessity, families at the very low end of the income spectrum have to combine that safety net with work if they're able to work. And we need to move away of sort of, you know, thinking about what, you know, welfare dependency as something to avoid at all costs, because the reality is the only way many of these families will rise above the poverty line and really start experiencing an increase and a sustained increase in income is if you combine those benefits with work. And that's a hard pill, I think, for our society to swallow, because we've tried so hard in the past to just move people off of the economic safety net. But unless jobs start paying better and families can really live on those wages alone, you need both.
So I'd also like to make one other point that I don't think that we're necessarily arguing that you have to spend more money, throw money at the problem. Part of it's just spending money smarter. So, you know, within the child welfare system, almost all the funding is essentially federal funding, can only be drawn down, the vast majority, for kids in out-of-home care. And there's not the flexibility to access that money for prevention funding.
So you mean there's funding once they get in the foster care system,
correct,
but not to help?
Not as much.
Correct. There's much, much less. And so, you know, to make funding streams more flexible and allow states and locales to draw down money for prevention and not only once kids are in the foster care system, could go a huge, you know, could potentially go a long, long way.
Anything else you'd most like to see change? You know, if I meet with you in 5 years and we're talking about the same problem, what do you hope is different?
I really hope that we as a society and the communities that we live in start seeing that this isn't an us versus them in terms of families and parents that are struggling with maltreatment, that there are some failures on the part of community and society that need to be fixed, and that people start to realize that that's important and accept it and want to do something about it instead of placing the entire onus on a family that's struggling, you know, to make ends meet.
And you?
And, you know, I think Christy said it perfectly, but essentially I'd like to see more stability and safer environments for kids. And so that less kids, you know, have to come to the attention of the Child Protective Services system, and that we can support them before we get to that point.
My guests have been Lonnie Berger and Kristen Slack from the School of Social Work, also in Lonnie's case from the Institute for Research on Poverty at the UW-Madison. Thanks to you both for being with me to talk about an important subject.
Our pleasure.
Great. Thanks so much.
I'm Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join me for the next hour of University of the Year.